When contemporary empirical social scientists investigate happiness, they typically try to track people's satisfaction with how life is going. When we try to determine whether our friends or family members are happy, we look to things like whether they seem to be enjoying what they're doing, whether they seem cheerful, whether they like where they live or work, whether they look stressed, bedraggled, annoyed, bored, or in some other way, well, you know, unhappy. Happiness, on any ordinary understanding of the term, looks to be a subjective matter. It's about the individuals and how they feel. Ordinarily, it would be very odd for even one's closest and dearest friends to insist that one is happy when one claims to be miserable. There are exceptions, of course. There are people who never seem to be content unless they can tell you that they can't sleep, or that they're afflicted by strange pains, or that they're aggrieved in some other way. No matter how often we express sympathy for those who seem always to see only what's wrong in their lives, it's hard not to notice that they seem to be enjoying the litany of complaint. Now, I have never said this directly to such a person, but I have seen such a person become alarmed when noticing that he had nothing to complain about, and not really relax again until he had a new problem to discuss. But notice that even if you're faced with someone who seems determined to be ill at ease, whose pleasure seems to hinge upon her own dissatisfaction, or worse, on other people's suffering, in trying to gauge happiness, you're normally trying to measure how individuals think that their own lives are going. Now, it wasn't always that way. One ancient Greek commonplace had it that one could assess a man's happiness, only assess it once he had died, since any measure of happiness taken while he was alive and thriving could mislead. I mean, he might lose everything tomorrow. Happiness, then, is something that individuals can have or lack. Those very individuals often, but not always, know whether things are going well for them. And how things are going for an individual has a lot to do with whether she's getting what she wants. That's why someone who keeps her eyes fixed on actual or imagined troubles, her own or those of other people, may be happy even as she insists that things are really terrible. Now, why is happiness important? Why should it matter whether restless human hearts get what they seek? I mean, philosophers have offered different answers to these questions when they allowed themselves to worry about why happiness is philosophically important and not just sort of personally gripping. There are a lot of things that are personally gripping but carry no philosophical weight or depth, sadly. Aristotle, Immanuel Kant, and John Stuart Mill all insisted that people are necessarily interested in their own happiness. We cannot help but care about our own happiness on these views, and our concern for happiness shapes how we live. The question for Aristotle was not whether happiness was worth pursuing. The question was whether one way of pursuing it was superior to the other available options. For Kant, the question was instead how to bring acting well, acting morally or virtuously, together with faring well, getting what you wanted to get, enjoying what you wanted to enjoy, avoiding what was repulsive to you, and embracing what attracted you. Although he thought that most people tended to do what they were supposed to do, I mean, most people were morally okay on the surface, he thought, he also thought that there was no way for anyone to be certain that anyone did what she was supposed to do for the right sorts of reasons. And he noticed that it was insane to think that a human being with her wits about her could think of no more pleasant way to spend an afternoon than by, you know, paying bills or helping an unattractive person who needed help, and so on. The question was how to understand the kind of happiness worth pursuing. The kind that didn't involve lying or taking advantage of others for the sake of personal gain. The question was how to give a sound account of tempering naked pursuit of personal happiness so that people were content to work toward being only as happy as they were good. This kind of happiness, Kant thought, could function as an ultimate end in human life. Something that could be entirely satisfactory and entirely satisfying. The sort of thing that everyone seeks if she is wise enough to seek something worth getting. The thought about ultimate ends is gonna do a lot of work for us. So it's the thing that it's really worth going for that's gonna completely satisfy you. Okay, now, John Stuart Mill crashed into a brick wall in his efforts to understand his own pursuit, not just of personal happiness, but of the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. He took it that directing oneself to the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people was the most worthwhile thing one could seek, even though, like Aristotle and Kant, he also held that some forms of happiness were better than others. So it's not just you're seeking everybody's, you know, good trip or something. It's not the kind of thing where you just want to distribute enough ecstasy and then you will have that. No, I mean, there's these things he calls higher pleasures, and those are the pleasures that actually engage the whole of the human person in a serious way. That was the kind of happiness that he thought was actually worth, you know, trying to make possible for everybody. And it fell apart for him in a spectacular way. In his autobiography, describing the ruin of his efforts to understand pursuit of the happiness worth having, he wrote, quote, "I was accustomed to felicitate myself on the certainty of a happy life, which I enjoyed through placing my happiness in something durable and distant, in which some progress might always be making, while it could never be exhausted by complete attainment. This did very well for several years, but the time came when I awakened from this as from a dream. It was in the autumn of 1826. I was in a dull state of nerves, such as everybody is occasionally liable to, unsusceptible to enjoyment or pleasurable excitement, one of those moods when what is pleasure at other times becomes insipid or indifferent. In this frame of mind, it occurred to me to put the question directly to myself. Suppose that all of your objects in life were realized, that all the changes in institutions and opinions which you are looking forward to could be completely effected at this very instant. Would this be a great joy and happiness to you, and an irrepressible self-consciousness distinctly answered, no? At this point, my heart sank within me. The whole foundation on which my life was constructed fell down. All my happiness was to have been found in the continual pursuit of this end. The end had ceased to charm, and how could there ever again be any interest in the means?" Close quote. Now, as is so often the case, as a friend and colleague of mine called Lauren Berlant often puts it, Mill's disappointment was an index of his optimism. He really thought that the life he was leading could have been enough to make him happy. And it really wasn't enough to make him happy. All three of these philosophers took happiness seriously. All three of them built their understanding of what it is to live a good life around their understanding of our interest in happiness. All three philosophers thought that there were better and worse kinds of happiness, or of pleasure, or of satisfaction. Happiness, pleasure, satisfaction, these are interrelated terms on these views. And that the kinds of happiness worth pursuing were kinds of happiness that engaged our whole range of cognitive, active, and emotional capacities. After all, if happiness is functioning as the name for what makes human life good, for something we want for its own sake rather than for the sake of something else, for an ultimate end in human life, then happy lives ought to be lives expressive of the best aspects of our humanity. Mill and Aristotle thought it was possible for people to enjoy the happiness worth having over the course of their individual mortal lives. Kant thought that individual human beings could pursue the kind of happiness worth having in this world, but could not secure it. Now, Aristotle was a pagan. John Stuart Mill was deeply involved in social reform movements meant to provide better education, housing, and a wider range of opportunities for the poor, and was committed to changing the laws so that women could own property, could pursue careers, and could retain some small level of security in marriage. He had been raised and remained an atheist. Kant had some sort of Christian faith, although his theological writings are at once completely characteristic and entirely uninspiring, I mean, to put it mildly. Kant's God is really thin, a really little God. But everybody necessarily believes in it. It's not much God. Suppose with Kant, Mill, and Aristotle that people are necessarily directed to their own happiness, that in seeking the many and diverse things that they seek, they are seeking happiness. Suppose also that in seeking happiness, people are seeking whatever will be ultimately and entirely satisfying for them. That they don't seek happiness because happiness is a means to getting something else, that they seek it for its own sake. And suppose that the kinds of goods that people see as crucial for their lives give us an indication of where they hope to find their happiness. Suppose also that the goods that people seek are genuinely good sorts of things for humans to go after. Love, for example, or wealth, social justice, or a warm and intimate family life, professional success, strong friendships or a good reputation, delicious food, health, or a secure and comfortable home. These are things that it makes sense to want. Are these things appropriate objects of human striving? You bet. Yes, they are. If you're not completely benighted if you're thinking that those are good kinds of things to go for. Right? And still, as we can learn from Thomas Aquinas and others, all these good things will not bring us perfect happiness, the kind of happiness that can serve as an ultimate end in human life. In a way, Aquinas urges us to develop a better imagination for our own happiness than anything that most of us manage to conjure up on our own, And that better imagination comes through a more robust and interesting understanding of faith than anything in Kant. I mean, certainly than anything that could be produced, I think, within what Kant calls the limits of reason alone. The boundary lines for theology in Kant. And if you've got a pretty big God, which Aquinas does, not a little thin, necessary God, but a big, infinite God. That's not going to be a thing that you can get to just through thinking clearly on your own. You're not going to get to the essence of that God just in the limits of reason alone. That's complicated. Okay, now, I take it as obvious that contemporary middle-class North Americans can do everything that they think one needs to do to be a good and successful person and find themselves with an enormous hole in the middle of their lives where the happiness or the sense of meaning was supposed to be. I have met many such people. They are in their early 30s. Their careers are going well. They have something that counts as family life for them. Some of them are even married and raising children. They have some sort of community, even if it's only the sort that comes from being a member of a team at work. They are healthy. Their lives operate from a sort of stable, functional core. And having worked very hard in school and then in university to get these lives in place for themselves, they find that their lives are inexplicably empty. Even though they sort of ferociously document and publish all kinds of images of their people and their pleasures with their omnipresent smartphones. I mean, this is constantly like, look, this is a moment when stuff was okay. Really, see the dog? Beautiful. Look at, Jason's walking, finally. Yay. Here we are in Hawaii. Sorry. I spent a lot of time talking to these people. Oh, look. What I find most fascinating about them is that they were not wrong about the kinds of things that it's good for people to seek. They were wrong in thinking that attaining those things would actually make them happy in the way they wanted or were hoping to be. Okay, now I'm going to draw from an unlikely source here in this setting. A highly successful American writer who became a sort of poster child for unhappiness when he killed himself in 2008 at like the age of 46, David Foster Wallace. Wallace gave one commencement address, and you can read it if you want to. And he said that, I mean, his thesis in one part of this address is that actually there are no atheists out in the day-to-day dog-eat-dog world, that everybody worships something, and that one of the most important choices you make is what you worship. Now, what he means by worship is the thing that you go to when you're seeking what's going to actually nurture you and feed you and give you what you need to live a meaningful life, okay? He wrote, quote, if you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, bromides, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid. and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect. Being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. Close quote. Now, one might think that the problem with looking for ultimate satisfaction in such things is that the pursuit is entirely self-centered. It's my beautiful intellect, it's my sexual allure, it's my power, it's my stuff. That appears to have been Wallace's diagnosis. It is true that all of my experiences are my own, so that from the point of view of my experience of the world we share, I am at the center of everything I think and feel, implicated in everything I love and anything I despise, and it's true that my happiness is mine. Still, if I think no further than my own satisfaction and the satisfaction of those in my intimate circle, it's no big surprise that my accomplishments will ring hollow. Perhaps the solution is to direct myself to a larger good, to have a field of engagement that brings me into a community of concern that extends beyond my own good and the good of those who are objects of my special care. Is that going to bring me happiness? Here, I think Mill's collapse provides an important object lesson. Mill, you may recall, was nothing if not other-directed. As near as we can tell, from childhood forward, he was deeply and powerfully involved in working on behalf of those who needed a strong advocate. He had a very busy life. He drew upon all of his considerable mental and moral strengths to improve the lot of others. He was clearly engaged in what Aristotle and Kant would see as virtuous activity, and he even had a strategy for finding the right sort of thing to orient himself to. I mean, in Wallace's terms, to worship. Right? It's this thing, durable and distant, toward which some progress might always be making. Mill's diagnosis of what went wrong with his life is helpful. What was missing, he decided in retrospect, was an orientation guided by the kind of emotional maturity that can only come from love. He thought that his life had been thrown off balance by relying too heavily on his intellect and practical skills. He didn't know how to move from love. And in this, Mill's diagnosis of what went wrong in his efforts to pursue a well-ordered society bears some resemblance to what Aquinas thought went wrong with Aristotle's account of the best form of human happiness. Aristotle thought that the most important aspect of human nature was human reason. This, he thought, is what set human beings apart from even the most cognitively impressive non-human animals. Well, for most young men, Aristotle's audience was comprised of aristocratic young men. Leading a life of virtuous activity provided the best hope for happiness. For some virtuous young men, there was an even better pursuit. Those virtuous young men with the requisite patience, discipline, training, and leisure could direct themselves to contemplation. Ideally, to contemplation of the highest things. Now, for Aristotle, there's some scholarly disagreement about this. The point where there is a bit of disagreement is not going to matter too much for the way I'm about to describe this. For Aristotle, the highest things were the perfect motions of the heavenly bodies. He thought that all motion came from the motion of these bodies, and that their motion did not come from any source outside themselves. These unmoved movers were the most important and highest things in the whole of the universe. philosophical contemplation of them amounted to contemplating something of divinity. The life of the philosopher in Book 10 of the Nicomachean Ethics then winds up being the best sort of life. You use your highest power to contemplate the highest thing. Okay. Denny Bradley summarizes Aquinas' criticism of Aristotle's treatment of the philosopher as the exemplary happy person. Quote, Aquinas does not wholeheartedly embrace the Aristotelian philosopher. He observes in an unfavorable comparison that while the Christian seeks to contemplate out of love for what is contemplated, Aristotelian beatitude arises out of the contemplative's love of himself. But if the Aristotelian philosopher is self-centered, so are his gods. Aristotle's gods, being perfectly actualized by their own self-knowledge, do not think about or, despite what the myths might say, love men. They do not will, as noble friends do, what is good for mankind's sake. And whether it is possible to love, even as much as one loves oneself, a god who does not love in return is a moot question. Friendship, which is built on equality and oneness of soul, does not exist between gods and men. The gods neither know nor need our goodwill toward them. Close quote. Aquinas shares the conviction of all the philosophers I've discussed that people naturally yearn for complete happiness. He shares their conviction that none of us can so much as coherently hope to satisfy this desire by immoral means. The happiness worth seeking must be sought in part through the development of acquired virtue, a good character, morality. But Aquinas works from a grounding in faith more impressive than anything we can find in these other thinkers. In this life, he thinks, we can, with the help of grace and through love, open ourselves to friendship with God. Now, this possibility is open to us not through our merit and not through our striving, but through the love that God already has extended to us and continues to extend to us throughout our lives. God is the one who beckons us to a life with God. If we ask for him, if we can get far enough out of our own way to be open to him, God is there. Through a careful, if challenging and sometimes controversial modes of argument, Aquinas sets out to show that since, as Aristotle helped us see, in seeking happiness, human beings seek to possess and enjoy perfect good, complete, entirely satisfying and entirely sufficient good, what they seek can only be union with what is perfectly, completely, and entirely good, beautiful, true. Whether we know it or not, what we seek in seeking happiness is, Aquinas argues, beatitude. Now, that is not a good we can attain without God's help. It is not a good that we can fully comprehend or understand, and it cannot be a good that we enjoy in this life. In looking for complete happiness, we're seeking God. That is what this life is for on this view. We come from God. By his love and through his grace, we may find the fulfillment we seek in him and with him in a resurrected life. Aquinas' writings on God's love, on the infused virtue of caritas, or charity, are the most detailed and nuanced of his writings on the theological virtues. In receiving caritas, we enter into a life with God in a way that reorders our relations to each other and our self-love as well. Through faith, we become conscious of our orientation to God. Through hope, we have the confidence to call on God for help that we're going to need to overcome the hurdles we face in life. But through charity, we entrust ourselves to a path of love and accept an invitation to friendship with God. Eberhard Schockenhoff describes the matter this way, quoting from and expanding on Aquinas' text. God is, for each person, the highest, unique, fulfilling good, and at the same time, what is most common to all. The longing of the human heart is so great and so deep that God alone is great enough to fulfill it. Only those finding rest in God, in whom there remains nothing of unsatisfied yearning that can become anew a cause of unrest, envy, and hate, can find peace. A human being will not have a peaceful heart, even if he should possess what he wants, so long as there is still something for which to strive that he cannot possess all at once. This longing comes to fulfillment in God, Aquinas argues. In him, universal peace and universal communication among human beings become real. The last word spoken about human life does not speak of battle, struggle, and exertion, but instead of peace over all grasping, rest without boredom, and joy beyond measure. That is how a Thomist diagnoses and sees the direction of this utterly basic and primal yearning for happiness that belongs in the human heart. Thanks.
Could you speak a little bit about the differences between the way Aquinas viewed virtue and Aristotle viewed virtue?
Yes. You just want the differences, or you want the overlap also? Overlap also. The biggest difference is probably like this. Both of them think that virtue is perfective of the human being. It corrects. Aquinas has a different sort of a story about what that correction is and how that correction works. Aquinas thinks that human beings, one of the interesting things about human beings, unlike all other kinds of animals, as near as he can tell, is that we have all of these powers that are actually made to be ordered with one another, coordinated, and to work together, but don't naturally do that. So we have these intellectual powers, and we have these sort of emotional and appetitive powers, right? And these emotional and appetitive powers actually are kind of made to be working with the intellect. I mean, that's how they're designed to fit together. But boy, they don't automatically. They just don't in human beings. So what virtues are acquired virtues, are habituated traits of character that you use that foster sort of cooperation and coordination of these powers, so that the individual human being can pursue human good sort of smoothly, reasonably. I mean, avoid things that are bad, reasonably, that sort of thing. That's what a virtue is in Aquinas. And he's got a more detailed moral psychology going with that than what you're going to find in Aristotle for a lot of reasons. Now, in addition to having habituated or acquired virtues, Aquinas also thinks that there are infused virtues. There are virtues that God can give us. Caritas is one of them. Hope is one of them. Faith is one of them. These are not things that we can acquire through practice and effort. These are things that are actual gifts of God. Okay? And these virtues, the infused virtues, instead of just being ordered to making us capable of individually pursuing human good reasonably and well, are ordered to beatific union with God. They're ordered to that end, rather than just to being right with our neighbors and so on. There are infused counterparts to all of the acquired virtues in Aquinas. The thought is, I mean, it's very hard to describe, the, I mean, you certainly can't give a mechanism for it. That's not it, right? Yay! But you can sort of get a sense of how it operates in a low-level and pedestrian way by talking about the way things are ordered. So suppose, I've used, this is actually somebody I know, suppose that you are a just person, you've got acquired justice in you, and you do a lot of work with at-risk kids. Okay. And you do that from a sense, from your justice, right? You want to give them the opportunities they should have, you want to help support them to develop the strengths they're going to need, all these kinds of things. And acquired justice should do that for you. Should, right? But now suppose you've got instead something like infused justice. These are not just at-risk kids that you have that you happen to be helping for whatever reason. These are actually eternal beings. These are children of God. If you're a Christian, these are beings for whom Jesus died. Right? That actually sets a different standard of care than just at-risk children who need the help of adults. Right? Like, that's the sort of reordering you get. I mean, love is supposed to be capable, caritas, God's love, reorders and reorients all of those virtues. So that, which is how come it can reorder all human loves. I mean, even self-love gets differently configured with caritas, according to Aquinas. Does that help?